I will call the meeting to order. And do we have a quorum? We don't have a quorum, so we will save the minutes until we do. And we'll start out, though, with Representative Brown, who is on the committee, so she can move her own bill. And welcome to Superintendent Brown and your other testifier, and we'll start with Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And if you would like to move your bill,
I can do that. I'd like to move House File 79 for possible inclusion in the K-12 Finance Bill.
Representative Brown moves House File 79 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. Representative Brown.
Madam Chair, some of the members of the committee are certainly familiar with the bill and some are not. This is the Wind Energy Production Tax that many districts in southern Minnesota, in fact, if you look at a map of southern Minnesota, it's the majority of the districts in counties in southern Minnesota are affected by this. Just a couple of years ago, we had passed legislation that would repeal the wind energy production tax, which what it ends up doing is it takes away 6% of the money that would have gone to the schools and now sends it to the state. And what we're wanting to do is repeal the repeal, basically, and reclaim those dollars, as we have schools in southern Minnesota that had anticipated the money, had ramped up their programs based on the money, and now it's going to be gone. I'd like to say that Superintendent Brown is certainly going to speak to the issue, but his story is not, you know, a single story. It is affecting districts across southern Minnesota, so although he's speaking for his district, he certainly is the voice of many.
Thank you very much, and we know he's a very articulate voice, so persuasive for members who are new to this committee, that we did have this in our K-12 omnibus bill last year, and unfortunately it had a different fate when it went to taxes, but we did like the idea and the trust idea, and there are new members on the committee, so we do want to hear it again. Superintendent Brown.
Thank you, Chairman Greiland and members of the committee. My name is Joseph E. Brown, Senior Superintendent of Grand Meadow ISD 495. And I'm pleased to have the opportunity to speak in support of House File 79 by Representative Brown and others. The effect of this corrected bill is to restore the legislative promise that was made to our local landowners and school districts in rural Minnesota in 2002 by providing additional revenue earned through the Wind Energy Production Tax under Chapter 279.029. Chapter 279.029 was originally passed in 2002 and amended in 2005. And as amended in 2005, in lieu of paying any property taxes, wind turbines are assessed a wind energy production tax at the rate of 1/12 of a penny per kilowatt hour of electricity produced. And in 2007, Section 12 of House File 2245, the Omnibus Education Act, was passed. This section reduced the amount of state aid to schools that is generated by the wind energy production tax. And in other words, school districts and local residents that were promised additional revenue for their schools will now have this revenue taken away by an equal amount through the reduction of state aid to schools. This may be the first time that local taxes paid in lieu of property taxes was taken away by the state of Minnesota and kept. Last year, a bipartisan effort was made to restore this commitment, but it was removed in the Tax Conference Committee in the last 2 hours of the 2008 legislative session. If we only had another 120 minutes left, or less time. Anyway, revenues collected from these wind turbines were supposed to be distributed to the local taxing jurisdictions by the following percentages: 80% to counties, 14% to townships, and 6% to local schools. And I do have in my packet a printout that I received from the Department of Revenue just on Friday evening that points out that this impacts 17 counties and 40 individual school districts. Under the original law, revenue would be distributed as follows, and this is based on last year's revenue. Last year, the wind energy production tax generated almost $4.3 million. $3.4 million goes to the counties, $600,000 goes to the townships, and the school districts were supposed to split the $257,000. The amount of additional revenue ranges per district from a low of $6.54 to a high of $55,912. Grand Meadow Public Schools, the school that I represent, would have received $29,374 this year. And in 2005, our local school board made the decision to require 4 years of math and 4 years of science for our graduating class of 2010, which is this year's juniors. They were counting on this additional revenue to pay for one additional instructor next year, who would be a math science instructor at the high school. Our resident landowners are extremely upset in our county because the legislative changed because the promise that they had agreed to install these large wind turbines on their farm is that this would generate additional tax revenue for their counties, for their townships, and most importantly, for their local public schools. The fact that this would raise additional revenue for local public schools was a real selling point in agreeing to sign a long-term lease for the installation of wind turbines on their farms. As a school superintendent, I sometimes feel as though I am taking a ride on a legislative yo-yo. Local superintendents need some type of legislative stability. We need to count on the legislative word that when you pass legislation, that you will maintain this legislation, hopefully for a generation of students. School superintendents are all being asked to do more with less. As all of you know, we do not currently fund schools equally across our state. I am looking forward to the day when we have a comprehensive school funding formula that is best for children. BEST is my acronym for balanced, equitable, simplified, and targeted. Some of you might call that the Minnesota miracle. In the meantime, my district cannot afford to have anticipated revenue taken away from them. With the adoption of this proposal, or without the adoption of House File 79, I will need to terminate one additional full-time faculty position in the next couple of weeks. Grand Meadow, by the way, did eliminate 11 positions this year. We cut 8.8% of our budget. We cut one principal, four teachers, and four support staff, and we are a growing school district. I understand the need to shift school aid payments as one way to assist in balancing the state's budget. I understand the need to possibly consider freezing the school funding formula for the next few years during this recession. I am only asking that the state distribute the wind energy production tax money already collected by the state to the 40 local school districts as originally promised in 2002. I want to thank you for your consideration, Chairman.
Thank you very, very much. And I like that. We'll have to get that in there and somehow and tie it in with the new Minnesota miracle. It's very good. This bill must pass. Okay.
We're done? Okay,
Mr. Grunseth.
Yes, my name is Randy Grunseth. I'm from Sargent, Minnesota, in Jeannie Poppy's district. I live right in the middle of the windmills. And I guess I'm not here to razzle-dazzle with numbers. The way I look at it, 2002, a deal was made to collect taxes instead of property tax. Farmers are signing deals with these windmills to have them on their land. There's a lot of farmers that don't want them. A lot of residents don't want them, but they saw a way to help their local school districts. And 2007, it was just simply taken away without, the way I see it, we didn't even know what happened down there. And guys are signing contracts while this deal is being taken away from us. And then in 2008, I see the same thing happen again. So it's an ongoing thing. There's guys negotiating as we speak windmill contracts, and they're under the impression they're going to help their school districts, but it's not. And the people that are catching on, it's stopping windmills. They're leaving. They're going across the state into Iowa and building down there. So we've lost revenue already. The state of Minnesota's lost revenue because of this issue right here. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And are there questions from members? Rep. Demdecky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see from the summary of this particular bill that the Department of Education was the one that brought forth this change 2 years ago. Is there someone from the Department of Ed here that could just talk to why they got this so forward and what their thoughts on it are?
Thank you. And there is. So we'll have her come down and give us the department's view on why they recommended this change last year. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Barnage, and I am sorry I did not know that we had brought it forward 2 years ago, so I will actually find out for you what our stance was, and it looks like Mr. Strom might have an extra comment.
Mr. Strom said he can cover for the department here, and we know the department is new and wasn't with us last session.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yep. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Depke, in 2007, when the department brought this provision forward, their testimony at the committee hearing was that they viewed the wind energy payments as a disequalizing resource and thought that these should be included in the property tax treatment or in an offset and not be separate revenue for districts because it was a disequalizing resource determined outside of the parameters of the school funding formula. Mr. Melcher testified at that time to that provision.
Representative Depke, the position of this committee was, and it was my position last year as well, was we didn't think it was the best policy, and the department had a point with that, but since it had been allowed and they had gone forward thinking that, it seemed an odd time to pull the rug out, and then also the tax committee had made similar provisions for some other districts, and so we thought, you know, we need to be fair and equal in how we do things and not just pick and choose, and so that wasn't good policy either. So no matter how you look at it, it wasn't perfect, but we thought maybe, you know, to be fair, that we needed to pass this bill both for the history and the timing of disallowing it and also the fact that the tax committee had similar benefits for some districts. Ms. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, can you give us a couple of examples of, in the fiscal note they use the term miscellaneous revenue. Can you provide some examples of other types of miscellaneous revenue where we do the general education offset right now? So how this would be, how the current law is consistent with other policy?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. This goes into a category of revenue called county apportionment, and these miscellaneous revenue sources that come to the county are those that are apportioned. Those include certain fines, certain fees for purposes. I believe there's one or two utility payments for specialized county utility properties in the county apportionment, not generally related to production at all. And there are estrays in there as well. But basically, they're a very small, relatively small category of revenue that go into this. I think the personal property tax perhaps is in this category as well. And so these all get rolled into this thing called county apportionment.
Madam Chair and Mr. Brown, how about taconite?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, there are several forms to the taconite revenue. Some of it is direct revenue for school districts, and in fact, in 2007, the legislature passed an additional carve-out of taconite funds as additional revenue for school districts. Some of the taconite money goes to reduce property taxes. So taconite is a combination. There's a very small amount that goes to reduce state aid. But taconite falls into all three categories. It's additional revenue, it's property tax relief, and it's a state aid offset. But primarily it's in the additional revenue and property tax relief categories.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, members, just so we're all clear on this, is that I think one of the motivations the department stated a couple of years ago is that with the renewable energy mandate that we passed, we are going to be seeing an explosion in this type of tax revenue produced from wind production facilities. So the size and scope of this is going to be growing and not diminishing. And in addition, Madam Chair, just so members are reminded that members of this committee who supported that bill voted for this provision not once, not twice, but three times that they voted in favor of this bill. So this should not be a surprise to members of the committee about the current law, excluding the freshman class or new members of the committee, that members did vote for this provision three times. And I'm not going to get as spun up as I did about it this last year. So thank you.
Representative Grapple, thank you for sparing us about that. We have three more members, Representative Anderson, Biskins, and Benson. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I've been involved a bit on the county level with the siting of wind farms, and the testifiers are right. It is a selling point when you try to talk people into locating powers on their land that the cities, counties, townships, and schools would get part of the revenue. So I support the bill. I thank you for bringing it up again, and I would urge that we pass it.
Thank you very much. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Brown, I appreciate you bringing this forward for your local school districts, but in light of the tax chair's recent proposal and her simplification of taxes and elimination of a variety of credits and deductions, have you had a conversation with her about this proposal?
Representative Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, I have not recently had a conversation with her about this.
Okay. I appreciate that, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Brown.
And I just wanted to point out also that this was included in House File 1812, which was passed on the House floor, and then did not come out of conference committee. So it has had some support in the House.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I do support what is going on. Last time this was up, but I just wanted to clarify in my own mind, before the construction of these windmills, at that time, the understanding was, is it not, that the division of the funds would go as listed here.
Representative, Superintendent Brown?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Benson, welcome back. Actually, it was. In fact, when I first went to Grand Meadow as a new superintendent in 2005, I was asked by the different wind energy companies to come and testify and also to listen to the public testimony. Hundreds of people showed up down at Grumpy's Restaurant, and I remember, you know, one of the big selling points is that if you sign this contract, 80%, 14%, and 6%. And the thing that really caught our farmers' eyes was 6% going to school. I appreciate also Representative Garofalo giving a history lesson. I'll give another one, too. In 2002, when Representative Pawlenty was in the House, he voted for this original bill. And so he's had some support. This has had some support from the governor's office as early as 2002. But that's the thing, that the trust issue is the issue that I want to bring forward. You know, the dollar amount, $29,000 may not sound a lot to some people, but to our small district, that's almost a full-time teacher. But the fact is, our farmers were told, if you sign this 20-year contract, this will be the division. And that was changed. And that's what I guess I'm trying to rectify.
I don't have a question, just a statement. And maybe I'm assuming there were government entities that were involved in the process to allow the construction of all these windmills, and so therefore the state of Minnesota, in some areas at least, was encouraging and supporting this activity. And it seems to me then that someone somewhere along the line in the tax committee or elsewhere suddenly discovered that this was an errant thing to do. Somebody did. So then, to me, there was a meeting on the promise. And if one reaches a point where you're doing these things and making these commitments and the community is, to me, that overrides other considerations. It's the fault of the state of Minnesota in some regard for allowing this to go forward and then finding out it made a mistake of some kind. The mistake was not made by the farmer and the communities. So that's fit the statement I have. That's why I support the bill. Thank you,
Representative Benson. Is there anyone in the audience who cares to testify for or against the bill? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Nyland on staff of the School Board Association. This came before our delegate assembly this year, and it was aside from the academic exercise of local control and general uniform state funding systems, we understand the inequities that go along with this piece. There's no question about it. But the story was compelling enough for our membership to support this position and understand that the complexities with the funding and the challenges that come along with it, I think it's something that the School Boards Association, their membership would support. So,
thank you very, very much. Anyone else? Okay, any closing statements, Representative Brown, or any of the testifiers?
Madam Chair, thank you so much for letting us come forward today. I would hope that the committee, and then as it moves further, the House in general support this bill, because it certainly is a step towards funding education better, at least keeping a promise as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Superintendent Brown and Mr. Grunseth.
Thank you.
And Representative Brown renews her motion that House Bill 79 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much. Representative Garofalo, have you looked at the minutes of March 17th?
Yes, ma'am. Sure, they look good. I'd move them for a passage.
Representative Garofalo moves the minutes of March 17th. Any discussion? All in favor say aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Representative Dale. Welcome to the committee, and we have another tax issue before us. And Representative Anzels, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, I will, Madam Chair.
Representative Anzels moves House File 733 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Dale.
Well, thank you, Chair Dreiling and members. It would be appropriate that Representative Anzels move the bill since his district is the only beneficiary, I believe, of the current swimming pool levy. But this levy dates back, Madam Chair, to 2001, which allowed such a levy for pool costs, direct pool costs, and the tests were that the district that could do this would border on border Canada, have less than 10 persons per square mile, and have the county in which the school district is located border one other school district. So as I think back about that, it's probably Representative Anderson that was the genesis of this bill, which was the predecessor of Representative Anzell. The present law allows and authorizes International Falls, Lake of the Woods, War Road, and Roseau to do the levy. And unfortunately, St. Louis, Lake, and Cook do not fall under this levy. So House File 733 amends the 2001 law to just require an international border as the pool levy test. That would include and add Badger, Cook County, Greenbush, Middle River, Kitson Central, Lancaster, Little Fork, Big Falls, South Kuchiching, all of which have no pools. It would also include Lake County and St. Louis County, which between those school districts have five pools. The levy would be effective in pay 2010. And the levy authorized under this bill would allow for the net cost of pool operation from the previous year, less any operating revenues that the school district might raise locally as their local effort, either from local units of government or other users, such as one group that uses these pools in these three districts are seniors. And frankly, the districts are trying to figure out how to pay for the pools, and so in the bill we say that they would have to deduct the local revenues raised from the proposed levy. This is not particularly a popular bill with the chair of the tax committee.
So, Representative Dale, you have talked to the tax committee chair.
I anticipated Representative Biston's question. In fact, Madam Chair, most bills that I do that go to the task committee, even though I serve on it, aren't that popular with the chair. In fact, her canned remark to me is, your senator is the tax chair. I'm not putting your provisions in, so he has to earn them in conference committee. So I don't have any illusion that this bill will end up in the tax bill on the House tax bill. I do believe that it will end up in the Senate tax bill. So,
Representative Bill, we appreciate your honesty and knowledge.
So I appreciate the fact that you are hearing the bill and to illustrate, you know, there are a lot of hurdles in trying to run pools. I don't know that much about running pools. I dive in the lake in the summer, but the truth is that along the border and up there, you know, just like, for example, you can still solar bill up north, you know, the heating bills and maintenance bills on these pools are a lot. And frankly, you know, St. Louis and Lake County have yet to pass an excess levy referendum after many tries. And I'm certain that they would have included the money to run their pools that they already have in their excess levy if we didn't have in St. Louis County over 60% of our property wealth tied up in seasonal recreational property, and if in Lake County we didn't have over 70% of our seasonal property wealth tied up, our property wealth tied up in seasonal property. Those levies would be such, which I know is another issue, as well as a tax issue, which the chair doesn't particularly want to solve either in the tax
committee. Actually, you're another supporter of the new Minnesota Miracle.
We love the Minnesota Miracle, too. We're a little stumbling a bit on the several billion dollars to fund it, but we're working on it, right?
Good.
That is the bill, Madam Chair. I'm willing to stand for questions. I know you love it.
Thank you very much. We love you, Representative Bill. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And the tax chair did just introduce a bill that looked at our 75-year-plus tax system and tried to clean the barn out of things that were not working or ineffective or things we couldn't afford. And I'm kind of just looking at the original rationale for this. And we do have, in the property tax division, we have cities that come in for special local government aid requests because they don't fit into the current formula, and then they have some unique need that requires them to do that. And I guess maybe, Representative Bill, do you know what the original kind of justification would be, and what would be the unique circumstances that would require you to, why this bill is needed? I mean, like local government aid, there are just special needs they have that don't fit into the formula need factor. Is that here? I mean, I don't, you know, just like in the income tax code, we've got some things that you wouldn't want to expand onto because they're not good to start with. And I'm just wondering what the rationale initially was for this bill and what unique factors there would be to go along the Canadian border.
Representative Dale.
Well, I can't say, Madam Chair and Representative Marquardt, that they are unique because our educational system is in great peril across the state. So I'll say, not being unique, but these communities have been devastated by declining enrollment. Because of declining enrollment in these communities, and these aren't just the new communities that are being added in if this were to become law, but mainly those northern communities, because of the incredible depression in the housing industry, because all the wood plants are essentially closed, short of Boise Cascade is making paper, the board plants I'm referring to. But really, frankly, Representative Marquardt, the fact that declining enrollment coupled with the fact that we are so handicapped by the 2001 tax bill that required, took the seasonal property off of our ability to levy and raise money. As I said, I wouldn't be in here for this bill if we could pass an excess levy. Now, I know that's not unique, but just the problem. So between, just thinking very quickly, declining enrollment and inability to pass an excess levy, and Representative Marquardt, you know, we could add North Dakota to this list of bordering communities as well.
Representative Marquardt.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Jones.
I'm not going to make that as an amendment, but I understand it, and, you know, but, you know, people decline and seasonal rec lost. I mean, that's kind of throughout the state, even in my area. And these swimming pools, I know, these indoor swimming pools, more so than outdoor, are very, very expensive to maintain and operate and so forth. And I'm willing to bet you'd have several school districts around the state that would want to do this. And I just, I don't like these type of piecemeal items of legislation. I just think we're kind of adding on to a piece of legislation that maybe policy-wise isn't so good to start with. That's kind of my concern.
Representative Gill.
Well, Representative Marquardt, I absolutely agree with you. I said I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for those circumstances. And I haven't, although I haven't, to the point that you made about other school districts piling on, this has been in the in-law since 2001, and I'm not aware of at least any other bills that have been brought forward so that the authors can be crucified in the tax committee. I think I'm probably the only glutton that will accept that kind of treatment, and I'm being facetious. The chair and I have had quite a discussion. I told her today I had 75 people in my office about the school levy when I saw her in tax committee today. It's become a running joke. I'll introduce her to people in the hallway. They're here supporting the pool levy. They don't even know who I am. Nonetheless, I don't have any other justification except that those pools, when they're not maintained in northern Minnesota, particularly north of Highway 2, they get very hard in the wintertime. The pools freeze, hard to dive into. The kids need to learn how to swim. And so we're here to try and do that. So
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Gill, anybody for or against the bill or have any testimony on this bill in the audience? I mean, no more questions from members, so Representative Gill, do you have a closing statement or have you covered it?
We love you.
All right. He's such a great legislator. Representative Ann Zells renews his motion, and House File 733 is laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Folsom, who is on the committee, so she can move her own bill as well.
Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 91.
Representative Slocum, move House File 91. Representative Slocum.
Madam Chair and members, this bill modifies health and safety revenue stipulations to include elevator repair and replacement necessitated by recent changes in the code standards for elevators in schools. I also, that simply is what the bill is about. I also would like to let you know that the Richfield School District recently received the 2008 Minnesota Finance Award which is recognition for its fiscal health and sound fiscal management and accountability. And I'm very pleased that they received that award, and I wanted you to know about it.
Congratulations.
Actually, Richfield is one of 118 schools statewide that received that award. I have with me today Michael Schwartz, who is the business manager for Richfield Public Schools, to tell you more specifically about Richfield's issue with this.
Very good. Welcome, Mr. Schwartz, and please give us your testimony and restate your name and title for the tape.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Schwartz, and I am the business manager for Richfield Public Schools, number 280. I appreciate the committee allowing me to testify in support of House File 91 to have health and safety revenue modified to include elevator repair costs. I want to thank Representatives Slocum and Thiessen for authoring this bill. And in 2007, Minnesota adopted new federal elevator codes. I provided you with information from the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry website listing the significant changes in the code. We have three elevators that require these upgrades and an estimated cost of approximately $500,000 to $600,000. These code changes must be completed in 5 years. Each year, Richfield allocates approximately $250,000 toward larger maintenance projects. If Richfield is not able to access health and safety funds for this major upgrade, the cost will vastly impede our plan to maintain our facilities for most of the next 3 years. We at Richfield take pride in our facilities. Most visitors comment how well our facilities are cleaned and maintained. This state mandate adversely affects districts with older buildings that need these maintenance dollars to maintain its facilities. The average age of our buildings is approximately 50 years. Obviously, with older buildings, you have older elevators, that most likely fall under the retroactive provisions of these changes. The mandate providing the changes in a five-year period, although not unreasonable, provides a burden to a district such as Richfield that has to update three elevators during this period. The school board was extremely surprised that the state would not allow the use of health and safety funding for this type of code change, since it directly affects the safety of students and staff who ride in these elevators. I just want to point out that Richfield strongly supports the passage of this bill, and also that AMSD is also supporting this bill. Again, I want to thank you for your time and allowing me to address the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schwartz. Representative Holcomb.
Madam Speaker and members, I would also like to add that I requested a fiscal note and it is not here yet. So, just as additional information, I anticipated that question.
Very good. Thank you. And Mr. Crow is up checking with Mr. Melcher. Do you know any more, Mr. Crow, about the fiscal note, or does Dr. Melcher? That wasn't what they were talking about. He doesn't. Okay. All right, because I think if Dr. Melcher, if you do know anything preliminarily, it might be good for us to hear about it, because I remember last year that Representative Thiessen had this amendment on the floor for the K-12 omnibus finance bill, and I do believe that we put it on in the on the House floor, and then later a lot of things ran into problems, but it seems like that there was a very large fiscal note on this, and that's maybe I'm remembering wrong, and so once they get them conferring up there, maybe we can find something out. But in the meanwhile, Representative Biskins has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is probably a question for Mr. Strom. Mr. Strom, is the health and safety levy an equalized levy? Is that why there'd be a concern with the fiscal note?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, the levy is equalized at a very, very low level, so only a few districts, less than a dozen, I believe, still qualify for aid under the Equalization Aid Program. It's more, in terms of its fiscal implications, it's more the issue of the House levy target. It would have a levy impact. The aid impact is going to be relatively small, regardless how many, what the total cost is, because so few districts qualify for equalization aid under the health and safety program.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And probably another question, follow-up to Mr. Strom. Mr. Strom, when the House fiscal staff puts together the levy target, what parameters do they use in creating that target? Because as I read the bill, I don't see that there is any increase in the levy authority. Right? It's an increase in the use. Does the fiscal staff not use the maximum levy amount when they are calculating levy targets?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, the Department of Finance is the unit that develops the fiscal notes. The Department of Education will provide them with the data that goes into that. That data will show if we expand the law to allow elevators to be replaced, that will essentially expand the amount of projects that happen under the health and safety program, which will lead to a higher levy impact. In terms of the houses, approach toward this, the House informally adopts a levy limit that is a bit of a mystery to me, I must confess, that for the last, at least for the last 15 years, the House has had a levy limit where bills essentially aren't authorized to be included in an omnibus bill if they were to raise the overall level of school levies above that limit.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And now, apparently, Mr. Crow has some information.
Madam Chair and members, the draft fiscal note, which isn't final, hasn't been vetted, so it's at this point something that it's just kind of estimated and hasn't gone through the process, has a number that's in the high single-digit millions, so less than $10 million, but more than $5 million at this point, and so it's because the department is presuming that under current law there could be some removal and repair but not replacement of those elevators. So that would be the expansion that would generate the additional cost under the fiscal note for the bill. And as been noted, there isn't much aid left in health and safety, so that's assumed to be mostly levy.
Okay, thank you very much. And Representative Biston now does have a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more. Mr. Crow, do you know off the top of your head how many school districts, or do all school districts right now cap health and safety revenue, or are there a number of school districts that are choosing not to levy those dollars at this time?
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, most districts do. There are some districts that don't use health and safety because they're in the alternative facilities bonding and levy program. Other than that, we can get an exact number, but the majority of districts are using health and safety to complete approved projects.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add, the other thing to remember about health and safety is it's not a formula allowance for pupil, it's project-based. So the more projects that are authorized, the larger the cost. It's not a dollars per pupil formula.
Okay. Thank you very much. I remembered something about that, because we just found it sounded so good to us on the floor, and then we got that later information. Mr. Crow.
And Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, it's not, there isn't a cap on that program either. If the department is approved, you know, if the districts are willing to levy and they had enough approved projects, then they could do, you know, do whatever they need to do. There's a cap on individual projects where they actually get converted into alternative facilities projects, but basically, since, as Mr. Strom noted, it's not a per pupil amount, it can vary greatly from year to year how much an individual district is doing, because it's just whatever projects they have approved. And we have about 324 districts, and then there's 20 in alternative facilities, so that gets you up to pretty much every district is using either health and safety, or is using health and safety if they qualify for it. About $75 million.
It's always a hard lesson for us here on this committee. So many of us would just like to let districts levy and not have that be a decision of the tax committee, but then, of course, we don't like to hear about high property taxes either. So, like a lot of things around here, we have two minds about a lot of these issues. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for the bill or against the bill, or either way? And it does have support of AMSD, and the AMSD is shaking their head yes. Very good. Okay. And there are no more members with comments or questions. Representative Slocum, a closing statement.
Well, Richfield would really like this, and it would help them have a safe building. Mm-hmm. And if you want to talk local control, this would be a decision that I think they should be able to make.
Thank you very, very much. And thank you, Mr. Schwartz, for coming down as well.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And Representative Slocum renews her motion that House File 91 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. Representative, oh, I guess we did the minutes. Representative Szymanski. Representative Szymanski, have you asked anyone to move your bill, or would you like me to move it for you?
I have not asked anyone, Madam Chair.
So I will move House File 777 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And welcome, Representative Szymanski. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Dreiling. This bill is asking for transportation funding permission, if you will, so that the public school district can reimburse the parents of parochial school students to get them to school. And the state provides a non-public pupil transportation aid for each non-public school student transported. Currently, the state of Minnesota allocates about $21 million a year for transporting non-public school students. The circumstances we choose to address in this bill is that when there is a non-public school located within the school district and another non-public school is located close by but outside the residence district boundaries, if the schools are considered to have the same appropriate departments, which includes the Department of Religion, then the schools are treated as being the same. And the bill that we have drafted attempts to address this problem by statutorily expanding the Department of Religion definition to include religious denominational synodical differences as well. The bill attempts to address this, and hopefully in a manner that does not excessively entangle the state in religious matters. With me today are folks from my area that represent both the Glencoe-Silver Lake School District and the Emanuel Lutheran School, which is just outside the boundaries of our Glencoe-Silver Lake School District. So I would first like to introduce Dean Scheel, principal of Emanuel Lutheran School, and he will provide some of the details. We do also have a couple of handouts in your packet, the letter from the Glencoe-Silver Lake Public School to Emanuel Lutheran School, and then a copy of the Minnesota rules regarding free and equal transportation to district boundary. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Welcome, Principal Scheel. If you could identify yourself again for the tape and state your name and then give us your testimony.
Yes, Madam Chairman. My name is Dean Scheel. I'm the principal at Emanuel Lutheran School in Hamburg. And I'll just give you a short little synopsis of the events that took place. Emanuel Lutheran School and its parents received a letter from the Glencoe-Silver Lake business office in July of last year, and I think you have that in front of you. Numerous discussions with Superintendent Sanju and Emanuel parents took place after that letter was received. Mr. Sanju said that he contacted a Mr. Sodegaard and a Ms. Wasika at the State Department of Education, and they supported his decision to withhold funding for our parents, the bus reimbursements there. We went to the Glencoe-Silver Lake School Board on December 8th and pled our case, and we were turned down. Our main points of contention were as follows. Emanuel Lutheran School has multi-grade classrooms, and First Lutheran, which is the other Lutheran school in the Glencoe-Silver Lake School District, does not, and we contend that that constitutes non-similar grades and departments because it's a completely different learning style. Number two, there were some other important differences we felt with the computer availability, guidance services, and a few other things that I won't go into. And the third point that I feel should have some validity, First Lutheran and Glencoe had two classes that were filled up. So even if our parents wanted to send their children to that school, they couldn't because those classes were filled up. I spoke with Representative Szymanski after the meeting, and here we are. I noticed that in a number of parts of legislation here, I think in different rules, you see the statement fair and equal treatment. And it's my understanding that through open enrollment, students can move from one school district to another and the money follows them. But because of the laws and rules, parochial school parents are not awarded this luxury.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Scheele. And Representative Szymanski, who is next?
Yes, I would like to introduce Mr. Glenn Grunhagen, a member of the Glencoe-Silver Lake School District number. Oh, I had it written down here. He'll tell you the district
okay,
number.
Okay, and he has to, of course, restate it for the tape anyway. So welcome, Mr. Grunhagen, and if you could restate your name and title and give us your testimony.
Yeah, my name is Glenn Grunhagen. I'm a public school board member in District 2859. Madam Chair, members of the community or committee, I'd just like to make a couple comments. One, you know, our district had been working with the parochial school in the past. However, there was an issue came up in terms of the reimbursement and the similarity between the schools. My understanding of the language before us would be that this language would help local school boards and administration better have a better language by which to make a judgment of the similarities between the school districts. As a school board member, I find working as much as possible with the parochial schools in and around our district borders is good. We have district students whose parents choose to send their students to those parochial schools. And we, as a public school, will turn to those parents and ask them to approve tax levies. So as a school board member, I find that the more we can cooperate and work together, the more positive outcome can be for all of us. As, you know, from a public school standpoint, we do not bus the students. They provide their own transportation. So all we are currently in relationship to their district is just a vehicle to pass the money through for the transportation expense. We take a certain percentage of that money that passes through our district for administrative costs. There's a letter in there that probably talks a little about, bit about the total money that goes through. So I, you know, as a school board member, but also as a citizen of the state of Minnesota, I see let's treat the children equally, let's treat taxpayers equally, and where possible, let's assist with the transportation costs, especially if it doesn't increase our district costs in any way, build some goodwill, and when that student, most parochial schools go to the sixth or eighth grade out in our area, I know there might be differences as far as that's concerned, but, you know, hopefully a lot of those large percentages of those students will wind back up in our school district. Finally, I would say this language is necessary because we have well-intentioned people on both sides of this issue in our school district who talk to the same people, read the same legal language, and come to different conclusions. You know, it's almost like it's written in two different languages. No, no, it's not, though. But
I find that around here, too, including about Type 3 buses.
I think the current language is a little bit ambiguous and could use some clarification. And as a school board member, I appreciate the opportunity of working with my parochial schools in any way we can, cooperate with each other, and even those that are on the border of our district.
Thank you, Mr. Grunigan. And your final testifier, Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My final testifier is Mr. Brian Milbrand, parent of a student at Emanuel Lutheran School.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Mr. Milbrand, and if
yes,
you could restate
you.
Your name.
Brian Milbrand. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to take up a lot more time here, but a lot of this stuff was covered with Glenn and Dean. I am a parent that sends my child, I live in Glencoe School District, and I send my child to across district lines to Hamburg Emanuel School. We drive him or her, both children, every day to school without busing or anything from the district of Glencoe. Years past, for the last 15 years, they have reimbursed us for that transportation from our district to the parochial school, and they discontinued that, and we just want some clarity in the law because we feel one thing and they feel the other.
Thank you very much. And before we go to member questions, Mr. Grafwall has one of the people who has signed up to testify on the bill who has to be over in the Senate for another hearing at 3:45, so he asked if he could be squeezed in here, and then we'll go to questions, and starting with Representative Marquardt. Mr. Grafwall. And Ms. Gilbert, you can be up there, but I'm going to take member questions before we go to any more testifiers. We're just doing Mr. Grafwall because he has to leave.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Jim Grafwall with Minneapolis Public Schools, and thank you for, I've got a meeting at 3:45. We had a nice visit with Rep. Szymanski, and I understand trying to solve this local problem, but we think it creates problems internally for us in Minneapolis schools, working with a number of private schools, non-public private schools, and setting attendance areas, working with them on the attendance areas, and we believe this is going to be a lead to an increase in cost for us in terms of transporting as private schools or non-public schools differentiate themselves amongst and between themselves. Right now we can say a private school on the north side, a private school on the south side. If you live north, your private school is on the north side. If you live south, but now if with this language in place, a party could say, well, the private school on the south side doesn't have this program or feature that the private school on the north side. So in an effort to help us continue to control transportation costs, I'd ask you to look seriously at this language.
Thank you very much. And now we'll do member questions, and then we'll continue on with the testimony. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. A quick question for Board Member Runehagen. Has the Glencoe Silver Lake School Board taken a position on this bill?
Runehagen.
Madam Chair, Representative, we didn't vote that night. It was just a recommendation of the administration to not continue the reimbursement. So there was not a formal vote at the school board that night.
Representative Marquardt.
Okay.
It was more of a, like Dean said, it was just turned down.
Okay, so Mr. Runehagen, your testimony doesn't represent the school board.
No.
Okay.
I just want to clarify. As a school board member.
Okay.
I'll let each board member speak for themselves.
I just wanted to be clear on that. Thank you very much.
Very good. Okay, there. I don't see any other members signed up at the moment, so if we could continue on, Ms. Gilbert.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools. And as Mr. Dressel said, and we discussed with the author, there's a substantial amount of case law related to equal treatment provisions for the purposes of transporting non-public schools. And the common branches of learning generally are accepted as, you know, math, English, science, physical education, and we do not differentiate, for example, between two different synods within the St. Paul Public School. We have two Lutheran attendance boundaries, you know, that we do for efficiency, and we work with the non-public schools to establish them. The other changes that say series of courses, customized styles of learning, religious denomination would just throw it wide open for additional transportation requirements for us, because each school could claim, you know, that they had a special program or a special series of programs within the district, and it would be hundreds of thousands of dollars for us to meet the additional requirements under this. And, you know, we've been pretty proud of providing really cost-efficient transportation. We have a very long history of collaboration with our non-public schools in St. Paul. However, this would be terribly expensive for us in light of the fact that we're looking at $25 million as a budget reduction right now.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Pupil Transportation, representing pupil transportation coordinators throughout the state. Ms. Gilbert and Mr. Grapple have given you very concrete examples, and I think if you would go throughout the state and some of the, especially some of the outer ring and growing suburban districts, that you'd see, you know, similar issues in terms of the complications that this would add and also then the additional costs that would go along with it. I think we want to go on record is that understand the issue, but also understand the problems that this particular legislation may result from it.
Thank you very much. Any questions from members or any other testimony? Mr. Grunhagen.
I just have a follow-up comment, Madam Chair, members of the committee. You know, basically, what I see this language doing is not mandating anything. It is expanding the some language for the average board member administration to interpret whether or not they want to do the reimbursement. But to me, it's not a mandate. It's simply we can decide as a board to vote or not to vote to do this with a non-public school outside of our district. And this is one additional rationale we could use and clarification in our determination of whether to do that or not. So I, you know, no disrespect to the previous, where'd they go? no disrespect to their testimony, but I think they're overreaching in terms of their interpretation of the language that's being suggested. Now, I'm open to correction on that, okay? But, and I'm not a lawyer. And I know lawyers can read between a comma and a period, but, you know, my own experience with it, coupled with the fact of what the language is actually to do, which is to give us additional guidance as board administration to make that decision, and we're not mandated to do it, so I see the concern maybe is a little overextended.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have a question from Representative Anzell, but it looks like Ms. Gilbert has a comment on the last, on something.
And Madam Chair and members of the committee, the way it's set up in the case law has confirmed it. Once you provide an exception for one school, then you have to provide an exception for all of them.
Thank you very much. And I think Ms. Gilbert is an attorney, so there you go. Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the author, I need to feel a little more comfort before I would support your bill. Could you talk to us a little bit about the school board, the local school board's decision of inaction on this matter, and why it is that one elected school board person acting on himself is here, and why the local board of education hasn't given this committee some guidance and some direction. I feel uncomfortable without that guidance and direction.
Rep. Dr. Manzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anzell. The interpretation of the existing statute was the the determination of the superintendent and with the advice of the business manager at the Glencoe Silver Lake School. And so at that point, they weren't asking the Board of Education for a vote on the issue. They basically determined that they thought they were not in compliance with the law by previously granting the transportation reimbursement. And so at that point, there was no call for a vote on the issue by the school board. And I think, this hearing here today, and thank you for the opportunity, was an opportunity for us to kind of bring this out in the open and say, well, maybe we need to clarify the definition in the law.
Representative Anzell.
Thank you for your answer. And just a comment to the members of the committee. I'm starting to feel that our committee is becoming kind of a, as a last resort, a state school board on steroids. I mean, we're being asked to go far afield in my view, and I'm still uncomfortable.
Thank you very much. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, Representative Szymanski, I think what Representative Anzell was saying is that if there was some sort of resolution passed by the local school board or some level of, so he knows where the local school board stands, he would be happy to support, maybe even co-sponsor your bill on this behalf. I think that's what he's saying. So thank you.
Representative Garofalo is always such a positive guy. I don't see any other members with questions. I just wanted to say I was corrected that Ms. Gilbert is not an attorney. She's just so smart, I thought she was, always quoting case law and things like that. So, Representative Szymanski, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just the observation that you drop a little pebble in the pond and sometimes it creates a large ripple. But I would simply ask that this committee consider this bill for further consideration, in that it is an attempt to give the local school board more direction and allow them the opportunity to decide locally how to resolve issues of this nature.
Thank you very much, Representative Szymanski, and I will renew my motion that House File 777 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much to the testifiers, Representative Szymanski, and members, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you.